Good Monday morning. It's Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. The frustrations that have convulsed Baltimore this spring have roots in police practices, yes, but also much deeper roots, roots that stretch back over a century in a history of various government policies that made racial segregation official. Take public housing, which has existed in the United States for nearly eight decades. As in many other places, government housing assistance in Baltimore has been a central safety net for the poor, but it also has perpetuated generational poverty and racial segregation. In the last 20 years, new approaches have been tried to replace government-owned high-rises, for example, housing vouchers or rent subsidies in privately owned buildings. Now there's another new idea, and Baltimore is one of the cities trying it out. It's called RAD, or Rental Assistance Demonstration. Proponents say it will bring long overdue funds into public housing in poor neighborhoods, but critics say it will let private businesses control a federal program that should remain just that, publicly funded. Donna McCone has been following Baltimore's public housing changes for the past year. She brings us this story on public housing's future and its past.
We're standing here at McCullough Homes. It was actually one of the first public housing developments that was erected by the Housing Authority at the time.
Lawrence Brown is a professor at Morgan State University. He studies how disinvestment and segregation affect health. In short, how policies in the past shape the Baltimore of today.
McCullough Homes function as a buffer between, to our west, what would have been black Baltimore at the time, and to our east, across State Center, there's the Bolton Hill community, which is white. And so by placing this here, it basically said we're going to do everything in our power to keep a divider between. So this would be a black community, and that's going to stay a white community.
Public housing was created in 1937. In the quarter century that followed, millions of African Americans left rural areas, and cities became more segregated. Housing projects were often built adjoining those segregated communities. Susan Popkin is a researcher at the Urban Institute. She's written several books on public housing. She says even though housing projects displaced people from slums and tenements, many were delighted by the new accommodations.
It was so much better than what they had before. They had a shower, they had a bathtub, you know, they had electric lights. And as bad as it looks to us from this vantage point, you have to think about where people were starting.
To hold down costs, housing projects were big. They housed huge numbers of people. Many communities were isolated and segregated by highways, and over time, residents included fewer working families and more of the very poorest. By the 90s, the aging buildings had deteriorated.
Public housing, you know, quote unquote, failed in a very public way, and they needed to come up with a solution that addressed the problem in a very visible way.
Eva Rosen is a sociologist and postdoctoral fellow at Harvard.
We could see the violence across the country in these poor neighborhoods. We could see the state of the buildings. We saw images of police trying to go into these developments and deal with crime. We saw images of just the state of the apartments on the inside, the holes in the walls, the elevators not working, lights out in the stairways. And these are problems we still actually hear about.
During the 90s, Baltimore's most troubled and dilapidated high-rises came down. Lawrence Brown says it wasn't just the high-rise model that had failed.
A lot of times they were demolished because the Housing Authority of Baltimore City did not adequately take care of them. They mismanaged funds, they did not fix up public housing, they did not keep it maintained properly.
In the mid-90s, people were transitioned to mixed-income developments, low-rises or the housing voucher program. With vouchers, families pay a portion of their rent to landlords based on their income. HUD covers the rest. Again, Eva Rosen.
So this is a way of relying on housing that already exists in the public market and relying on privately owned properties to house the poor.
Rosen lived in Park Heights for a year starting in 2011. She studied the neighborhood for its mix of homeowners and renters. Rosen found that some landlords are concentrating vouchers in the very neighborhoods the program was designed to get them out of.
They recruit tenants, they select tenants, and they make decisions about who they want to keep. And in particular, it turns out that landlords who have properties in more disadvantaged neighborhoods have a sort of a perverse incentive to attract voucher holders to these neighborhoods.
She says landlords are less likely to rent to voucher holders in more affluent communities because they can easily find tenants to pay those rents. In poorer neighborhoods, landlords are more likely to end up with tenants who struggle to pay rent.
And so if they're able to attract a voucher tenant to this unit, then they're able to collect whatever the housing authority sets that rent at, which tends to be often as much as a couple hundred dollars more a month than they might be able to get from a market tenant. So they're able to get more rent, and they're also able to get the rent that they do get on time.
Housing vouchers represented a new way to house those who need it. Not all Baltimore's housing complexes have been knocked down, though. The city still owns about 22 buildings, many in poor shape. Peter Engel of the Housing Authority oversees the redevelopment of public housing.
The Housing Authority of Baltimore City estimates that we have a backlog of deferred maintenance and capital needs to do roofs, windows, heating systems, all of that sort of capital work. We have a backlog of about $800 million for our roughly 11,000 units.
Under a new program called Rental Assistance Demonstration, or RAD, real estate companies don't just lease to people in their buildings, but actually buy a part of the housing projects. At a meeting in Park Heights last year, Housing Commissioner Paul Graziano told residents the city is in a bind. With the funding that comes out of Washington, it would take 200 years to fix the buildings. He asked the PAC room if they want the 200-year plan or the 2-year plan. Sharon Jones of Bell Park Towers went to the meeting. She plans to keep close track of RAD and question developers' incentives for renovating.
And I know these people want their money back, so what price do we have to pay for them to get their money back?
Peter Engel of the Housing Authority says RAD frees up money unavailable with the traditional housing model by converting public housing subsidies to Section 8 subsidies.
What it allows a housing authority to do is to go to the private sector to borrow funds and to use the low-income housing tax credit program. And both of those programs allow us to bring in a lot of capital to rehab these buildings.
Since the 90s, this public-private model has developed mixed-income communities around the nation. Sociologist Ed Goetz, who wrote New Deal Ruins, says that's a complete rethinking of public housing.
From a design standpoint, from the standpoint of no longer being a public program exclusively, but one that is really focused on attracting private sector investment, it has been driven by this logic of dispersal and deconcentration of poverty, which has justified the demolition of a lot of units of public housing and the loss of that housing stock.
Though RAD won't result in a loss of units, some residents, like Gary Shroud, are concerned about permanent affordability in a city where there are 70,000 on the waiting list for subsidized housing.
We are the backbone of Baltimore! We are the workers!
Shroud led a rally against RAD last year. He lives in Bernard E. Mason Senior Apartments in West Baltimore and has been organizing with the Right to Housing Alliance.
And now you want us to live where nobody want to live? We don't think so!
Shroud says the original plan was to sell the land, the building.
The whole 9 yards. We had to speak out. They decided they wouldn't sell the land.
The Homeless Persons Representation Project, other legal groups, residents, and the Housing Authority have been working to negotiate RAD's implementation. Advocates say initial policies would have effectively screened out new residents, who most need the housing subsidy. They've also been looking at other cities rolling out RAD, because even though it's a federal initiative, local housing authorities shape the details of how it happens. Another change hammered out along with residents was leasing the land public housing is on, rather than selling it. As it stands, the Housing Authority has the option to buy the RAD projects back in 15 years when the low-income tax credits expire.
We don't know a lot of things, but HABC will be in the driver's seat because we have the right to buy it back, and that's what's important. So that means at that time, people will be able to evaluate the situation, and if it makes sense for us to buy them back so that we can refinance them again, rehab them again, keep them strong for another 15 or 20 years, I'm sure that's what people will do. If, on the other hand, with the way financing works and the restrictions have all been working and the buildings are still serving the people they're supposed to serve, we'll have that opportunity to keep the development entity or the at-ownership entity in place, refinance that way, and make sure that they'll continue to be, again, affordable for this very low-income population.
I reached out to a few of the 11 developers listed on the Housing Authority's website. The community builders got back to me but said they can't comment because the contracts are still in negotiation. The unknowns leave many residents worried about the future. A meeting a few weeks ago showed miscommunication between the Resident Advisory Board, the group that communicates with the Housing Authority, and tenants.
And you need to get together with the tenant council, whoever it is, and get this stuff right and work it out, because I'm not going nowhere.
misinformation.
That's Gary Shroud from the RAD protest. He helped facilitate the meeting.
When you privatize, you should be able to have a voice in it. You know, the public, the people that it affects should be able to have a voice in it. I'm not organizing a gang to go out here and commit crimes. I'm organizing people to understand where they live, how they live, what they can do to help themselves live better. If you don't know what's going on, you can't help yourself.
Shroud says the Housing Authority has not made it easy to understand the complex changes taking place. He wants people to take more ownership of where they live and not feel intimidated to do so. That's the kind of bottom-up change, he says, that could get people out of poverty long-term. Ed Getz, a sociologist, sees the ambivalence about maintaining public housing as a reflection of racial divides in the U.S.
There was a great deal more support for public housing before it became associated with a quote-unquote welfare-dependent population, before it became associated with largely non-white population. Its stigma is associated with the types of people who are most dependent on public housing. And in most cities, that's people of color and people who have trouble finding a position in the labor force.
Without addressing patterns of racial discrimination, Getz fears public housing will continue to be seen not as a valuable resource,
but rather as something that we'd like to see go away.
For Lawrence Brown of Morgan State, the demolition of public housing paves the way for gentrification.
This is valuable property. It's all about real estate.
We're back at McCullough Homes, where two apartment buildings will be rehabbed through RAD.
This is the first city to sort of employ RAD on such a large level. That's all the remainder of the high rises in the city. And a lot of them are elders and where seniors live. So in 20 or 30 or 40 years, you won't have a lot of opposition because most of the people that live there won't be alive anymore. No matter what this looks like, you're actually sitting on a gold mine, and you need to do everything you can to stay where you are and to take control of it if you can.
Brown says he hopes residents can take ownership of the RAD process to win a better affordable housing system, because both the private and the public sector have failed poor African Americans in Baltimore. As the city moves forward with RAD, there's a lot at stake. Is partnering with private entities an investment in public housing's long-term affordability and the communities that depend on it? Or is it another step in the too familiar process of dismantling poor Black communities? Reporting from Baltimore, I'm Jonna McCone.
Producer Jonna McCone reported this story with an Equal Voice Journalism Fellowship from the Marguerite Casey Foundation and the Journalism Center on Children and Families. Thanks to former Maryland Morning intern Brandon Block for his help on the story.